Hello and welcome. Today, we're going to be speaking with Gretchen Rubin, the author of the number one best-selling book, The Happiness Project. And on today's episode, we're going to be speaking specifically about the four tendencies and how they relate to people pursuing financial independence. Welcome to Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, today we're going to be talking about communication, how to communicate this idea, this vision for financial independence to your spouse, your loved one, your partner. The inspiration from this comes from Elizabeth from our community. She said, one of the things that I think you need to do is you need to reach out to Gretchen Rubin and ask her about the four tendencies in FI. We actually did an episode called The Why of FI. In that episode, we're really exploring our own personal reason for pursuing this idea of financial independence, getting to the point where working is optional. And we realized that many people heard that and have taken it back to their spouse, their partner, their loved one. In some cases, that partner buys in immediately. In other cases, it's like they're talking to a stone wall. And realizing that your personality traits, your tendencies are probably a huge part of that interaction means that we have a gaping hole in the type of information that we've collated up to this point. Having now read the four tendencies at Brad and many other people's recommendations, I can tell you that I think this is it. I think this is the missing piece. If you're looking to communicate and communicate effectively, this will not only help you realize these personality traits that you may see in your own life, but I think honestly, more importantly, give you a better understanding of how and why you're interacting with other people, what's getting results and what isn't. So I think this is going to be an incredible, valuable episode. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this for quite some time. I've been a fan of Gretchen's for about a decade now. So this is a real treat for me. We look at financial independence as an overall life optimization strategy, and it means living a better life. And interpersonal skills, interpersonal communication is a crucial part of that. I've found, actually, just since rereading the book, that I've had a deeper level of empathy for people that I've met, and we'll go into a story or two in the next hour, but it's fascinating when you can read something and then have an interaction with someone where you would have just recoiled and said, oh, I think that person might be a little crazy. And then you look at it and say, oh, wow, now I understand because of their tendency. So it's truly, truly fascinating. And with that, Gretchen, welcome to Choose FI.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. I'm so pleased to be talking to you today. I can't wait to get into it.
Your trajectory in this space and really helping people talk about habits, productivity, mindset, happiness. I mean, talk about breaking through the noise. I mean, you've kind of led the charge on this, on all this research and built an incredible community around this. I believe last time I checked, your tendencies quiz, which we'll link to in the show notes for this episode, has been taken by over 500,000 people.
And 2.5 million now.
Wow. Dated.
Yeah. Last time you checked.
I checked a year ago, right?
Yeah.
That was my problem. So anyways, I think that just speaks to the level of value that people are finding when they understand these patterns. This isn't to put you in the box, but to recognize that this exists all around you. And when you see the pattern, you're able to then affect change on that, or at least learn how to adapt to it. And I'm curious, The Four Tendencies was not the first book that you wrote, nor was it the second. In fact, it took you a really long time to put that book together in terms of the actual research that you were doing. What was the source for the book? Just tell us where this came from.
Yeah, you're right. That was far down the line in my writing career. So I had written three books before I wrote The Happiness Project. And that was sort of the book that put me on the map kind of in this happiness, good habits, human nature arena, though I felt like I'd been writing about human nature all along. And so I was writing about happiness. And then that led me to habits, because a lot of times when people would say, well, I want to have more happiness because I want more financial freedom, or I want to pay down my debt, or I want to get more sleep or read more, whatever it is, they're really talking about habit formation. So that led me to habit formation. And I wrote a book called Better Than Before that was all about the 21 strategies that we can use to make or break our habit. But in writing that book, I started seeing these differences in how people viewed habits. I love habits. I feel like habits are energizing and stimulate my productivity, my creativity. I have a very warm feeling about habits, which is probably why I wrote a book about habits. But then a lot of people would sort of like, why would you write about such a loathsome subject? And then people would say things like, well, New Year's resolutions, I would never keep a New Year's resolutions because January 1st is an arbitrary date. And I thought, that's funny. Arbitrariness of January 1st never bothered me. But the real insight came when a friend of mine said, I know I would be happier if I exercised. When I was in high school, I was on the track team and I never missed track practice. Why can't I go running now? And I thought, well, why? It's the same person. It's the same behavior. At one time it was effortless. Now she can't do it. How do you explain that? How is that affecting her habits? At one time, the habit came easily. Now the habit is not coming easily. What's going on? And that is what led me to what you guys were talking about, the four tendencies, which is a personality framework that explains how people come to these situations from different perspectives. They have different challenges. And I think you're so right to point out that if you understand how someone has a different perspective or a different kind of challenge, you can set things up in a way where it'll work for both of you. Because a lot of times we just assume everybody sees the world we do. And then when they don't, we're just sort of like baffled and frustrated. Doesn't make sense to us. When you understand where other people are coming from, it's much easier to arrive at that solution that both people can accept and embrace and execute on. If you don't know the tendencies, there's a lot of kind of like, let's throw some spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks. And that can get discouraging for people if they keep trying and failing on something that's really important. I mean, like in finances, this is stuff that people talk about all the time as being really, really a high priority. Then the question is, okay, well then why aren't you doing what you want to do? Or why is somebody else not seeing the vision that you see? How can you communicate more effectively and set things up for more success?
So, you know, we have a community of approaching right around 500,000 people. It's going to be interesting as we kind of direct people to do this quiz and to take this test to see what actually comes back. I'll tell you one of my first thoughts when someone suggested to me, hey, you should take this tendency quiz was, well, I don't want to do that because I doubt your ability to take all these personalities and put them into a simple framework. Someone suggested that someone wanted me to take, I think, the Myers-Briggs, or they wanted to know what my Myers-Briggs was. And I remember taking it in school. I had never looked at the results and I never wanted to interpret the results because I reject the basis of this analysis just in its entirety. I opened up your book and I'm on page 2, right there on the page. It's like, there are people that will actually question. And that is in and of itself one of the frameworks. So tell us a little bit more. Let's start with that. Like I question your ability to put me in a box.
Well, the fact about this quiz is it's looking at, and we can get into sort of like the definition and people can figure out what they are as we're talking. But one of the things is it's looking at a very narrow aspect of your personality, something like Myers-Briggs or the Enneagram or, you know, a DISC, things like that. They try to paint a whole picture of a person. This is very, very specific. And so I think in that way, it's easier to get like a strong hit because I'm not trying to tell you a lot of things about you because a lot of things could be different about you. If you lined up 50 people who had who were questioner tendency, you're a questioner, you lined up 50 questioners, they could look very different in a lot of different ways. How adventurous are they? How analytical are they? How extroverted or introverted are they? What are their values? But as to their questioner nature, that would be very consistent. And that tells you a lot about somebody. It's a narrow aspect, but it's a very significant aspect.
So let's talk about when you applied this framework to yourself, what you found, because you would not have been able to build this framework just by analyzing yourself because you don't fulfill all four of the personality traits.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about this at the macro level and then how you went about collecting this and what you found as you did.
No, it explained a ton about me because my tendency, the upholder tendency, what you often find when you get a bunch of upholders together is we all start saying like, why is it that other people just like can't get their stuff done? Like, what's the problem? And if you look at a lot of people who write and talk kind of in productivity area, a lot of them are upholders like me because upholders are like, my system works great. If you would just follow my system, you would have the same results. They don't understand any system works with upholders because that's what upholders are good at is like executing like that. But not that many people are upholders. It's a very small tendency. And I remember going to my husband and being like, oh my gosh, I figured out the upholder, questioner, obliger, rebel. It all makes sense. I figured it all out. But what I realized is I'm part of kind of this extreme fringe personality type. And he was like, you think? Like he was not surprised because it was very obvious to him. And one of the things that's really fun about the four tendencies is once you know them, you see them everywhere. They're not subtle. They're very obvious. You see that in your spouse. You see them in your coworker. Game of Thrones. I can take you through all the main characters of Game of Thrones and tell you what tendency they are and how they fit very predictable patterns that you would expect to see with the four tendencies, because they're just ubiquitous. There's movies. You know, I can tell you famous people, because if you have enough information about how somebody thinks about, you can't just look at what they do. You have to understand how they're thinking about what they're doing. If you have enough information, it's pretty easy to tell their tendencies. These are blatant.
Yeah, Gretchen, we certainly want to get the definition of the four tendencies and pass this along to the audience. But I'm curious about the inception of this. When you're devising, you're ultimately devising a way to look at people's personalities. How quickly did you hit on it being four particular tendencies as opposed to six, eight, 12? Talk me through the inception of this entire concept.
Well, I have to say, it was like the most difficult intellectual undertaking that I've ever done in my entire life. And I was like a clerk on the Supreme Court, you know, so like that was hard. This was harder because I didn't know what I was looking for. I saw patterns in the world, but I didn't know if they were connected or not. Maybe they weren't. Why is the fact that somebody says January 1st is an arbitrary date? Why is that connected to somebody who said, I will never schedule an exercise class on a Saturday because I don't like to have something on my schedule? Why is that related to someone like me who loves a calendar? My friend on the track team, how are these things fitting together? I didn't know if they did fit together, and I didn't know how they fit together. And so I was just in my mind, as I was studying habits, I was just had all these stories and patterns, just kind of ruminating on them. I couldn't make sense. And then one day I was sitting at this very desk where I am right this second, and all of a sudden I was looking at my to-do list, and all of a sudden the word sprang into my mind, like flashing, expectation. Which is kind of a dry word. I wish it were like a juicier word, but what are you going to do? Expectation. And I started thinking about expectations. That's when it hit me that there are two kinds of expectations that people fall into or experience. Outer expectations, like a work deadline or a request from a friend. And then inner expectations, which is my own desire to keep a New Year's resolution, my own desire to write a novel in my free time, my own desire to get back into playing guitar. And as I started thinking about it, I realized that people experienced outer and inner expectations differently. This explains something that had always puzzled me about. There's something called the Big Five personality test, which people now kind of accept as the most reliable and useful general way of thinking about people's personalities. And one of the factors in the Big Five is conscientiousness. Now, I'm highly conscientious. And that makes sense to me. And I understand people who aren't conscientious. I get that too. What always puzzled me was people who were sort of like patchy conscientious. Like in one area of their life, they were super conscientious, but in then other areas of their life, they weren't, didn't seem to me to be conscientious at all. And that didn't make sense to me because I was like, why are you doing something different in this context than that context? What's making that different? And when I hit on expectations, that's when everything fell into line. And what was so exciting about it is like, you know, if you study nature, nature is perfect in its elegance. The periodic table of the elements, the frond of a fern, a nautilus shell, these things have a geometry to them. They are complete, they're elegant. And when I started doing, I realized that each of the tendencies completed a framework and each was related to the other. And it was all, how do you respond to outer? Do you accept it or do you resist it? And how do you respond to inner? Do you accept it or do you resist it? And so that leads you to four possibilities. Accept, accept, resist, resist, accept, resist, accept. Those are the four tendencies. And they all fit together. People can lean to one way or another. And I was just like, this is like the periodic table of the elements. You know, it all fit. And everything I was thinking about, I had a million examples in my mind. And I would think, well, what about this? And what about this? And this person told me this. And I've seen this pattern that doesn't really make sense. How would I explain that? Like, there's this weird thing called Obliger Rebellion, which was a very striking pattern I couldn't make sense of. Then I figured out how it fit in to the model. And so once I had that model where everything was complete and nothing was left out, I was like, okay, this is a model that works, but it took me forever. And then the quiz is like the short, quick quiz. Oh my gosh, the quiz was really, really hard. It's easy often to get down to two tendencies, but then to distinguish among four tendencies, to have a question that's kind of broad enough that everybody can kind of get it, and yet people answer four different ways. Oh my gosh, it was like I could feel the steam coming out of my ears. It was such a hard thing. So it was very, very hard to come up with this.
The questioner in me wanted a different option for each question. Like, can I get another option?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, that's very questioner, right? Like, I can think of an exception to this. Yeah. It was very demanding.
I love that at the macro level, you were able to pin it down. Clearly, your book goes into the nuance and explains how something might at first glance not look like, for instance, we could talk about Upholder. I really would like to kind of spend some time on each of them, but let's just talk about it in the context of Questioner. My gut told me that I was probably going to follow somewhere into the obliger because I think about myself as a people person. But as I was reading through Upholder, the only thing I knew, because this is the way you go through the book, probably selfishly because you're the Upholder, go through the Upholder first, right? As I read the Upholder, I knew I am not an Upholder. 0%, I will not touch any of the boxes. And then I read Questioner. What's interesting as you're reading your book is you're very quickly picking out other people in your social circle. And you're like, oh, my wife is an Upholder. Wow, she's an Upholder. Brad, oh my goodness, he's probably some version of an Upholder or a Questioner. It's very easy to pick out the patterns. And then you get farther and you're like, oh, well, wait, that could be me. Oh, okay. All right. But I still thought I was going to be an obliger because I feel like when people ask or need something, I'm happy to step up and help. The part in the, as you're kind of going through the question, you realize is the questioner like immediately takes every request that they get and they internalize that in terms of, you know, how that is going to affect their own internal expectations. And I was like, oh, wait, I do that. And that was a subtle difference that made me realize it's not at my core that I'm always saying yes to everybody all the time. It is this kind of internal pivot that I'm making at such a micro, at such a quick level that I don't even recognize it. And that's like it's like a nature issue, I guess.
What you're pointing out is that a lot of what you do depends on your values. And so sometimes you'll do something because it's a value, but you're doing it from your tendency. So sometimes people think that rebels would be very, very kind of selfish and inconsiderate because they do what they want. They do what they choose to do. They resist outer and inner expectations. And so in some cases, that can look very kind of inconsiderate and like, I don't care about anybody else. That's true. But then you also have rebels that have a very, very high value on being good citizens, good bosses, good family members. They're doing it because that's who they are. That's their identity. That's what they choose to do. They're choosing to do it out of love for you. So they're acting in a way that serves their value, but they're doing it from the rebel tendency. And you can get into situations where you kind of have to go through a couple different scenarios to get at the tendency so that you see the tendency apart from the value. Because there's no tendency. And then you say, oh, obligers are people pleasers. Not necessarily. There are some obligers who like, they only do something if they're going to actually get in trouble. They don't have any interest in pleasing people. Pleasing people is not necessary to be an obliger. It's about meeting outer expectations and having trouble meeting your inner expectations. But if you please people about that, well, that's kind of incidental.
So I'd love to spend some time and dive into a little bit of the nuance of the different tendencies. And I guess before we even do that, let's go through definitions. I know we said at the highest level, it has to do with expectations, but in broad strokes, what are these tendencies?
So exactly. It has to do with how you respond to outer and inner expectations. And you're either an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or a rebel. So upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline. They keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what other people expect from them, but their expectation for themselves are just as important or more important. So their motto is, discipline is my freedom. Then there are questioners like you. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. They resist anything arbitrary or unjustified or inefficient. They're making everything an inner expectation. If it meets their inner standard, they'll do it no problem. If it fails their inner standard, they will resist. And their motto is, I'll comply if you convince me why. Then there are obligers. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. So I mentioned my friend on the track team. That's what she was. When she had a team and a coach expecting her to show up, she did it no problem. But when she's trying to do it on her own, it's a challenge. The thing for obligers to remember is if they want to meet an inner expectation, they must create a system of outer accountability. This is crucial. Don't think about self-care. Don't think about priority. Don't think about motivation. Don't think about reasons. Think about outer accountability. You want to read more? Join a book group. If you want to exercise, work out with a trainer, take a class, work out with a friend who'll be annoyed if you don't show up, exercise with your dog who'll be so disappointed if she doesn't get to go on her daily run, think about your duty to other people, raise money for a charity. There's a million ways to create outer accountability, and that is what obligers need if they are going to meet an inner expectation. So their motto is, you can count on me, and I'm counting on you to count on me. And then finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. They can do anything they want to do. They can do anything they choose to do. They often love a challenge. Like, you say I can't save $10,000 in a year? Watch me. They often like a challenge, but they do something because that's what they want. And typically, they don't like to tell themselves what to do. Like, they won't sign up for a 10 a.m. spin class on Saturday because they don't know what they're going to want to do on Saturday. And just the idea that someone's expecting them to show up is sort of going to annoy them. So Rebel's motto is, you can't make me, and neither can I. And the interesting thing is that there's a very consistent pattern in how big the tendencies are. So the biggest tendency for both men and women is obliger. You either are an obliger or you have many obligers in your life. It's a big tendency. After that, questioner. Rebel is the smallest tendency. It's a very conspicuous tendency, but it's a small tendency. And then, Brad, you and I are upholders. That's only slightly larger. It's also a small tendency. So most people are obligers and questioners. So if you're creating a curriculum or you're thinking about kind of the world, you often kind of think about questioners and especially obligers. Rebels and upholders are a little bit more on the extreme and the rare.
What I notice about your book is you're not trying to, like, the case you're making is not that once you know your tendency, you're trying to change your tendency. Oh, there's all these advantages to being an upholder. I should just stop being a rebel and be an upholder. That's not the point of the book.
Mm-mm. Each of the tendencies has great strengths and then also corresponding weaknesses. And each category, I could tell you people who are hugely successful and also big, big losers. So I really do think that what works is, like, when you understand your tendency, you can kind of see, like, okay, what are my strong points? How do I lean into that? What are my weaknesses and my limitations? And how do I offset that by, like, setting things up in a different way or picking a different way to frame something or set it up so that I'm more likely to succeed. So for instance, if you're a rebel, rebels hate doing any kind of repetitive drudge work. We all hate doing repetitive drudge work, but rebels really hate it. So one of the things that you say to rebels is have everything on auto pay that you possibly can, because rebels often have a hard time paying their bills because they hate sitting down and paying bills. They're being told what to do. Do it on auto pay. Other people, not such a big deal. Or I talked to a rebel who paid bills and I was like, how do you do it? She said, oh, I do it at work when I'm supposed to be working. I'm paying my bills. I was like, okay. You know, she's like, you can't tell me what to do. You think I'm going to be working? I'm going to do what I want to do. Then obliger, it's like, okay, accountability. Like, maybe you want to put something up on the fridge. Like, okay, I am committing to this family. We are going to save for the summer vacation. And here's a picture of a beach house. And I'm committed that I'm going to do XYZ thing that's going to get us to the money that's going to get that beach house. And if I don't achieve that aim, then we're not going to go. And so I'm going to feel that tremendous accountability to my family because I've committed to that. And they're all kind of like, yeah, how's that going? Whereas a rebel might really not like that. They don't want somebody looking over their shoulder, telling them what to do or reminding them. They want to feel more free. And like a questioner, it might be like, I've decided that this makes good sense. I'll just execute it. I don't need some picture up in my fridge. Like, I got it. I figured this out. Compound interest is my friend. Like, I just want to do it. So again, you can set things when you know your tendency. It's not that you want to change yourself, because that's very hard if it's even possible. You want to change the way things are set up so that you get where you want to go. We can all get where we want to go, but we might take different roads to get there.
Yeah, it's interesting, the self-knowledge, certainly. And I think it's also made me look more empathetically at people in my life.
Yes.
Which is wonderful. And also, frankly, like how I interact on the podcast. Like, I'm thinking back now almost sheepishly of how many times I've said, what I use is the Jocko Willing quote, discipline equals freedom.
Yes, right? That is upholder.
And that's upholder.
If that's your motto, there you go.
Right. I mean,
that's it upholder.
As clear as day. And, you know, like my mom, for instance, she is the epitome of the obliger. She does for everybody, and she never does for herself. So, like, maybe she has to set up or we have to help her with outer accountability. It's interesting how that works. And I'd love to hear you talk about the tendencies and how they overlap with other tendencies. So you can lean toward, and I think about me, because Jonathan actually thought I was either an upholder or a questioner. I think clearly it's upholder, but I think back to times in my life where this one just sticks out. I was probably 17. This was the one single time I went golfing. They told me I had to wear a collared shirt, and I just like internally freaked out. I literally contemplated driving home, cutting a collar off my shirt, like clothespinning it to a t-shirt and just saying, by definition, this is a collared shirt. You lose. It was so arbitrary and ridiculous. And like, I'm seeing now.
You left your job because they changed the time to come in from 8:30 to 8 a.m.
Yes. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. So I don't love arbitrary rules. So like, clearly the questioner comes into it. And I think I have some overlap there. And I'd love to hear you talk about how people can lean.
Well, nobody likes something that's arbitrary. Everybody wants like things to be justified. Nobody likes to be controlled. So we each have a little bit of the tendencies of us, but I do think that there's ones that dominate. But you're exactly right. If you think about the tendencies, like if I had my book in front of me, or if you take the quiz online, you'll see this. You can visualize a Venn diagram of four circles that are overlapping in a diamond shape. So let's say you're an upholder. You and I are upholders. So upholders, they overlap with questioners because both upholders and questioners readily meet inner expectations. So they have a lot in common. Upholders also have a lot in common with obligers because they both readily meet outer expectations. And so you can be an upholder who tips to questioner, which sounds like that's you and me both. Brad, it sounds like you and I are very similar. And then there are upholders who tip to obliger. And so it will influence how it comes out. It will kind of flavor the tendency. You're still in that core tendency, but it will express itself differently. A big thing for some questioners, they don't like arbitrary rules. And so something like the speed limit can really bother some questioners because they're like, that's arbitrary. I'm a good driver. I should drive fast. You're a bad driver. You should drive slower. Why are we all driving the same speed limit? It makes them crazy. Questioners who tip to upholder, which is like my husband is in this category, they're kind of like, okay, I get it. It's arbitrary, but what are you going to do? You can't like let people make up their own rules. You know, it's the law. Like this is how society works. Whereas questioners who tip to rebel are much harder to persuade and they have a lot more trouble with things like that. Like five garments to a dressing room to some questioners, they're just like, how can we live in a country that does this?
Right?
Because this makes no sense,
right?
You know? And so again, you see that they're still questioners and they have that core questioning thing, which is if you ask or tell them to do something, they're going to say, why should I? But some it's easier to convince than others. And so that's how you tip. So you do see rebels who tip to questioner are more like, I want to be me. You can be you. Can't we all just like march to the beat of our own drummer? Rebels who tip to obliger are more like, I want to tell me what to do and I want to tell you what to do. And I really resist any, like you, I'm really, really, really sensitive to anyone trying to control me. You're telling me to do something I already wanted to do. Well, now I'm not going to do it because you're telling me to do it. And so like now I'm not going to. They have much more of that spirit of resistance and resentment that can come. So that's how the tendencies relate to each other. So they're in a continuum too. And that's a very kind of natural thing where everything is related to everything. Everything is connected and everything is kind of shaded, kind of like the color spectrum. You know, at some point, green, the colors change, but there are shades where you're like, could be this, could be that. It's kind of hard to tell.
This is a sidebar story, but my wife is going through the immigration process and her lawyer just sent her a form that she needs to fill out. And at the bottom in the email, the lawyer says, all right, and you need to sign this in blue ink. And my brain just broke.
Yes,
I mean, a black pen won't suffice. This literally has to be I just want to sign it in black, or I want to know why,
or purple.
So anything, anything. Tell me why. A couple other points that I noticed.
Tell me why. That would be a great motto for the questioner. Tell me why. They'll get on board with anything. Tell me why.
There it is. So I think this kind of brings us to the second part of that is that you have people that are on this path to financial independence. This idea that to kind of go to the whole discipline equals freedom type thing. If you live your life with intentionality now, as opposed to just saying, well, we can afford the payments on everything. You know, instead of just doing that, you have focused some intentionality to your financial decisions early on. You can reclaim decades of your life. And it's so obvious when you see it. It's so obvious, quote unquote. But then you take this idea that you're incredibly excited about back to your friends, your family, your spouse, and you tell it to them. And for whatever reason, they don't get your enthusiasm. And I'm just curious, like, I think this is the natural next step here. As we take whatever you are, it doesn't really matter what you are for this situation, but you take all those around you that you're trying to take this idea. Because really, in order for you to do this, you need buy-in. What are the strategies? What are the ways that you would need to present this information to not reflect your own tendency, but someone else's?
Yes. Well, I think you're exactly right. Because like, let's say you're a questioner. A lot of times questioners think, if I just give you enough information, if I give you the data, if I show you that why this makes so much sense, you will be convinced. And they get very, very frustrated when people to them seem like they're acting irrationally when they're not convinced by the data. That's not how other people get on board with things. Let that go. If you're not dealing with a questioner, that's not the quickest, easiest way to get there. So you tell me in your community, what is the pushback? What form does that pushback take? What are people saying why they don't want to buy in? Are they saying things like, well, our kids are used to like a certain level and we can't deprive them of that? Or like, what are they saying? Life's too short, we should live now? Or what are the arguments that they're hearing back? What form does the pushback take? Because that's what you need to think about. You need to think about answering the, from that other tendency. It's like, if you know the five love languages, it's not your tendency that matters. It's your sweetheart's tendency. You got to speak the language they understand, not what you understand, because otherwise, because then they're like, I don't understand what you're saying. I don't speak Japanese. You got to speak the language they speak. So what is it that they're saying? What is their, what's their roadblock?
Yeah, I certainly think we see the two examples that you set up. I think a lot of people hear it and think, if it was so easy, why isn't everybody doing it? Or
this That's very defeatist.
Right? Yeah, or it's too good to be true, I've heard as well. You know, there's an aspect of the YOLO that we don't want to deprive ourselves. So, I mean, I think that's a huge part of it. I think a lot of people look at buying things as bringing happiness. And that may be in the moment, as opposed to we look at achieving financial independence as buying the ultimate luxury. And I think it's hard to see long-term for some people.
And what is the kind of thing that a person would do, like everybody around them would buy in and they would make a certain kind of change? What kinds of changes are you, are kind of the typical kind of changes that a person who's successfully doing this is starting to make in their life?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of this, as opposed to action, really just goes to mindset. Are you supported in this? So to your direct question, the actions that are taken would be one, probably for most people where they're starting this conversation, let's sit down and talk about our money. Let's talk about our finances. Let's get clarity and align on goals. And they can't even get buy-in on the goals, right? Like I think that's probably the biggest thing. If they could start with a conversation, that would get you information and then you could work towards that or at least know where you are, but you can't get someone to sit down at the table and look at your finances. Without knowing an individual's unique situation, that's the one that I guessed is the most painful, you know, because like if I could just get you in a conversation, get you to commit to what you want your life to look like, we could engineer that.
Right. So now I've got ideas, like concrete ideas that I think that people could try. So let's start with obliger because that's the biggest tendency. So probably a lot of people are dealing with obligers who are not getting on board. So what can you do to create the outer accountability that's going to make an obliger feel like, okay, I need to buy into this? One thing you can do is you can have a, like, if you're going to talk to like a financial advisor or something, go ahead, make the appointment. And you're like, look, this is expensive. If we're going to go in there and really use that time efficiently and get some answers, well, we need to have everything figured out in advance so we can go in there efficiently. So we need to know, we need to have our statements. We need to have our information. We kind of need to know what's going on because I made this appointment and we're going to go and we're going to spend the money. And so let's get the most out of it. That's the accountability of like, there's somebody else. There's a third party who's looking over your shoulder and there's an appointment where you're going to get charged whether you go or not. So maybe you don't want to go. Well, look, if you don't go, we're just going to blow the money. We got to go. That's a form of outer accountability. A form of outer accountability also that works is to think about your duty to others. So it's like, look, I know money is emotional. I know growing up, there was so much anxiety around money. You just don't even like to think about it. But look, we're not alone in the world. We have people, like, if we don't get a handle on this, maybe we're going to be dependent on them. That's not good. That's not good for them. That's not good for us. Or maybe they're going to turn to us. What if there's an emergency and we're not able to help? What if we get into a situation where, like, this is a crisis and we drag our children, our parents, our siblings, our friends? We have a duty to get this figured out. Because we're not alone. And if we get to a place where we really are secure and strong, we can be the helping hand that we want to be. We can offer our children extra summer camp lessons. If there's a reading problem, we can get a reading specialist. If our parents, if they need something special when they're older, like we can do the things that are going to make that easier for them. We're going to be able to provide that. And so it's that obligation to the person. Also the obligation of the future self. Hey, look, I know you don't want to sit down and do this, but if we get to the end of the year and we're no closer to getting out of debt than we are right now, we are going to be really annoyed with ourselves. Let's say, hey, it's money 2020. Let's do this thing. Let's come to the end of the year and you are going to look back and be so happy with what you did. The future self. Apps, like a lot of times obligers don't break the chain, can work very well for them. There are a lot of apps about budgeting, monitoring, which is a great thing if you're watching people. I write about that in Better Than Before. If we just monitor something, we tend to do a better job of it. But of course, you're talking about people who don't want to monitor. They don't want to go there. But it's like maybe a little app could help you just get in the habit of seeing where your money's going day to day. And that's a form of, that can be a form of accountability that works. So that's obliger. Another person, kind of person that I think might have trouble with this is rebel, because rebels don't like to feel constrained. They don't feel like, they don't like to be told, no, you can't do this. They tend to like want to do something right now. The way they get to a rebel is they put such a value on freedom and choice. And so you, and you mentioned this in what you were saying, tie it into this idea of freedom, choice. Do you want to be controlled by debt? You want to be chained down by the banks and the credit cards and all these people who are just clamoring and taking money out of your pocket? Do you want the freedom to choose? Look, you know, we could have money to travel. We could go anywhere if we had the money. Like, this is choice. This means that no one can tell us what to do. If we get to this place, we can say to everybody, who cares what you think? But until we get to that place, we're trapped. We're chained. They're going to come looking for us. They're looking over our shoulder. Let's get to a place of freedom. Let's get to a place of choice, because I don't want anybody limiting my ability to make the choices that I want or do what I want to do. Maybe we want to move to another country one day. I want to feel like I got the money to do that. Maybe I want to like build a porch on my house. I want to have the money to do that. I want to be able to do what I want. Money gives you the ability to do what you want. Freedom from debt gives you the ability to do what you want. So that's very compelling. Now, questioners, it's all about running the numbers. I remember my father's a questioner, and years ago, he was quitting smoking. And, you know, there's a million medical reasons to quit smoking. The reason he quit smoking was to save money, because he would run the numbers of how much he spent on cigarettes. Then he would think if he invested it and he made a certain level of interest and, like, you know, returns. And then if he made this amount of returns, it would be this much. And he'd run it for a month, 2 months, 6 months, a year. He was like, I want the money. So with justification, if you see that one kind of justification isn't working, maybe try another kind of justification. Okay, maybe we're going to get that summer vacation house, that rental house that we want. Well, that's a good justification. Or another justification is, look how much money we're blowing on interest. Look at these numbers. Look at this
graph. Sounds like you're describing spreadsheets, to be clear.
That can be very compelling. And within a upholder, it's not that hard. It's like, I'm going to put this on the calendar. It's time. I know you don't like thinking about this. We're going to put it on the calendar. Wrap your mind around it. Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, we're both going to get a big cup of coffee. Play the scrambled eggs, and we're going to sit down and we're just going to face it. And if an upholder, it's like, put it on the calendar, let them get their mind around the fact that it's coming, especially if it's something unpleasant. Pick a time when people are rested and ready for something that can be very anxiety provoking, as you know. And then just say, we're going to do this, sit down and do it. And especially if what you're starting with is like, we're just going to survey. I'm not asking you to do anything, sacrifice anything, change anything. We're just going to get a handle on like, what is the situation? That often too can be to people like, okay, well, information, who can say no to like information? And then when you get to the point of like, given the information that we have, what do we do next? Then you can really start to do it. You know, and so for making that thing with the rebel, you could be like, hey, you tell me when you're up for it. And it might be 11:30 at night. And they're like, hey, you know what? You want to sit down at the dining room table and review all those documents? And you're like, yes, I do. When the rebel's ready, you are ready. Let them pick the time and do it. With an obliger, you could say like, okay, you know, we got to do this by the end of the month, or we're going to, you know, still be some kind of penalty or some kind of issue that we're going to face. So again, in many, many stages and in many, many ways, thinking about the tendencies can shape the way you frame something in a way that can make it easier to succeed.
Gretchen, a lot of people wrap their identity up in their profession. Clearly, there are outer expectations. Yet we in the FI community are looking to not retire early and sit on the beach. We're looking to get to a point of freedom. I'm curious about obligers, who are clearly the outer expectations are a huge aspect for them. Like, do they lose that so significantly when they're in retirement, early or not? Like, how do you see that working? And how do you see that point for the other three tendencies as well?
Well, that's a really, really important point. And a lot of times obligers do struggle with retirement for a couple different reasons. One problem is that obligers often think that if outer expectations would go away, then they would meet inner expectations. So what they think is going on is like, I'm sacrificing what I want to do for others. So I'm putting what I want to do on hold because I'm so busy meeting what other people want me to do. That's not what is happening. I would say that isn't what's happening. You're meeting outer expectations and not meeting inner expectations. That seems like kind of a subtle difference, but it's actually very important, because I had an email from somebody just the other day saying, I took early retirement and got less money as a result because I thought if I just quit this demanding job, finally I would have time to do all the things I want to do. I want to remodel my house. I want to start gardening. I want to lose weight and get in shape. I've done none of those things. And I'm like, why not? because you have no outer accountability for those things. The mere fact that this demanding job has gone away doesn't make any difference at all, because that's not what was keeping you from these things. It's the outer accountability that you need. And so it is a big thing for blighters, because for many people, they don't even realize how much they depend on outer accountability because the workplace provides it. You have deadlines, you have teammates, you have deliverables. It's like there's outer accountability as far as the eye can see. That's why a lot of rebels like to work for themselves, right? They don't like that. They don't like being in that structure, whereas obligers often thrive in that structure. And so if an obliger retires or like goes into a kind of freelance type situation, I see this as a writer a lot. Well, somebody might be perfectly productive when they're working at a magazine or a newspaper where they have deadlines and an editor and, you know, the paper or the magazine, but then they go to write their book, they go on book leave, and they're like, oh, I have writer's block. I'm like, you don't have writer's block. You don't feel like you have the weight of outer accountability that you need. You need to say to your editor, hey, every month I need to send you a chapter. And if you need to email me and be like, hey, where's that chapter? I'm waiting for it. I need it. I'm depending on you to keep to the schedule because I've organized my work life around it. And then they'll do it. And so retirement or like leaving the workplace, kind of the natural architecture of the workplace, can be a challenge for obligers, and they need to think of other forms of outer accountability. It's interesting. I have an app, this app called the Better app, and it's a free app that people can join. And one of the things you can do on the app is form accountability groups. And some of those accountability groups have been formed by people in retirement who are sort of like, let's just be accountability for each other for whatever it is that we're trying to get done, because they do need that. They always need that outer accountability. And as I said, people are puzzled because they're like, I'm retired. Why can't I do this thing that I've always wanted to do? It's like, because you don't have outer accountability.
Let's talk in the context of identity and also your personal journey. You, as you mentioned, were a clerk for the Supreme Court, and you walked away relatively early in your career to pursue your own passions, your own, I guess, a new identity, starting from scratch. And I'm just curious, with your own tendencies in mind, forging that new trail, just walk us through what it's been like on the other side of this and kind of what this life that you built for yourself, effectively achieving financial independence in the process.
Well, for me, I think my tendency absolutely influenced how I made that shift. So for me, I was more going towards something than leaving something. I had a great time in law, but while I was clerking, I had the idea, I became totally preoccupied with the subject of power, money, fame, sex. It was like power, money, fame, sex. It hit me like a lightning bolt. I started doing hours and hours and hours of research. This is something that I've done throughout my life. I just did this with color. I did it with placebo. I'll just get really interested in something. And I was doing more and more and more research. And finally, it hit me like, this is the kind of thing that somebody would do if they were writing a book. And then it hit me, I could write that book. And so I went to the bookstore and got a book called something like How to Write and Sell Your Nonfiction Book Proposal. And I just followed the directions. And this was, you've put your finger on something that I really was thinking about as I was coming up with the four tendencies. Because people would often say to me, how did you get yourself to do that? How did you get yourself to write a book proposal and a sample chapter and do all that when you didn't have an agent? Like, how did you get yourself to do it? And I was always like, well, I just wanted to do it. So I did it. I mean, like, that's what I wanted to do. So yeah, I mean, I bought a book. It told me what to do. I just did what the instructions said. And I'm good at that. I'm an upholder. Upholders are good at that. And so that's the kind of, and I knew that about myself. I hadn't invented the idea of upholders yet, but I knew from my life. Brad, I don't know if you feel this way, but one of the things that I love about being an upholder is I feel that the person that I can trust the most in the world, that I can rely on the most in the world, is me. I can rely on myself more than I can rely on anyone else. And that is an enormous source of comfort. And I don't think all the other tendencies feel that way necessarily. So I find that very reassuring. Now, could other tendencies make the transition that I made? Absolutely, 100%. I could absolutely see a questioner do it. I could absolutely see an obliger doing it. I could absolutely see a rebel do it. But I do think that knowing that, hey, I'll buy a book, I'll do my best, I'll give it my best shot, I'll succeed or fail. I mean, I'd gotten to the point where I was like, I'd rather fail as a writer than succeed as a lawyer, so I better like try. It did kind of suit my personality, because something like writing a huge book project in my free time, yeah, I do that all the time. That's not hard for me. So I think it did help me make that transition in my own way.
Yeah, it's so interesting, because I usually look to ask for the thought process during that point. These inflection points. And just to set the stage here for the audience, a Supreme Court clerk is basically, what are you, probably 25, 26. It is probably the most astounding job a 25 or 26-year-old could get on the face of the planet.
It's very hard to get that job. Yeah.
And I mean, you're literally, in many cases, writing Supreme Court opinions. It's one of my buddies from high school was a clerk for Justice Kennedy, and I'm intimately aware of how astounding it is. But you made this shift that I'm sure other people in your life looked at as, wow, Gretchen, what is she doing? She went to Yale Law School. She's a Supreme Court clerk. She's throwing it all away. But yet you said to yourself, who's the person I can trust the most? Myself. Mm-hmm. Did other people push back or did you even care, frankly?
Well, it's interesting. I feel very fortunate. At the time, I didn't think anything of it, but looking back on it, especially now that I have children myself, I really do appreciate it so much more that my parents were very supportive of me taking a big risk. And the fact is, it was a big risk. I didn't have any clips. I had never published anything. I'd never even like written a short story. I had no credentials. And like, you're right. I had great law credentials, like which I'd been working so hard to get. And then I was like, okay, having done that, I'm going to start all over from zero. You know, and I think sometimes the people in our life, out of the best intentions and with the deepest love, don't want us to risk failure. They don't want to see us disappointed. They don't want us to take big risks that they feel like could have bad consequences for us. And so they try to keep us, they try to encourage us to stay on the safe path. But the problem is, like, what have we learned from the last 15 years? There is no safe path. There is no place of safety. It's like, okay, you could do this and then it all blows up, or that whole industry goes away, or it's transformed so much that like, you can't help somebody else be safe other than just like trying to get them to build their skills and like stay in the game. But it's not like, oh, you should go to accounting school. Certainly the law profession is like, you know, my father's a lawyer. He's a super happy lawyer. The law profession is nothing like what it was when he was starting out, when he would have been my age. And he knew that. So I felt very fortunate that everybody around me was very, very tolerant of me taking a risk and very much encouraging me. And my father said something to me that I found immensely comforting that other people, when I repeated it, actually thought was very harsh. But to me, it was very reassuring. So I was going to write this book. And my father said, now, look, darling, you might not knock it out of the park the first time, but you'll get there if you want. And I thought that relieved me from the burden of having to like come out with a big success. Because he was like, hey, if you want this to be the long game, it can be the long game. Because sometimes people are like, well, you can give it one shot. And if that one shot doesn't work, then I want you to go back to accounting school or whatever. And it's like, that's not how things work.
You get a second and a third and a fourth shot.
It's a false choice.
That's amazing. All right, Gretchen, thank you for being so generous with your time. On most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready. Bring it on.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Gretchen, question number one. What is your favorite blog, podcast, or book of all time? And I know you are a voracious reader, so I am really interested in hearing the answer to this.
I can't pick one favorite because I got like multiple favorites.
You got to keep it to less than 20.
Yeah, give us a couple then.
Okay, well, podcast is easier because there just aren't as many podcasts in the world. So I love 20,000 Hertz. I love my sister's podcast, Happier in Hollywood. I'm listening to Dolly Parton's America right now. For books, I love children's literature. I love adult literature. A book that I most often give as a gift is a crazy book called A Pattern Language, which is like this weird rogue architect, Christopher Alexander, about how to look at spaces, which I find super fascinating. If people say to me, what's the one book I think everybody in the world should read? I say Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Favorite Saint Harry Therese's Potter book?
Story of a Soul has been very influential to me. I could keep going forever.
Gretchen, what's your favorite Harry Potter book?
Maybe Goblet of Fire.
Okay. Figured that might stump you, but very nice.
All right.
I love them all. I love them all.
Question number two, an inflection point in your life that was especially memorable or meaningful.
Well, switching from law to writing for sure that we talked about. Yeah, that was major. And then the day I met my husband in the law school library, that was a big moment. Wow. We fell in love at first sight. We got engaged like 6 months later. That was a big moment. Wow. I knew it was a big moment when it happened too.
All right, Gretchen, question number three, your favorite life hack?
Get enough sleep.
Nice. Oh, you were
you upholders. I tell you what, can we talk about the downside of upholders? Let's say you're going to visit your friends or family in a different time zone. How does that play out, Gretchen?
Well, it's funny that you say that because when I go to the West Coast, I usually try to stay on East Coast time. And like my sister who lives in LA, she's the co-host of the Happier podcast with me. She's very understanding about it. Like she'll be like at 4:30, she's like, do you need to eat dinner now? And like, she won't make plans at night because she'll be like, well, I figure you're probably going to want to go to sleep at like 8. And we never thought anything of this, but we were talking about it on the podcast one time and I got this email from somebody being like, I can't believe how selfish you are. And I was like, literally, it never occurred to, as an upholder. I'm like, what are you going to do? I got to get my sleep. I'm only here for 2 days. I'm not going to try to stay up and adjust to Pacific time. And then I'll just go back to the East Coast. So if I can, I try to stay in my time zone. Oh, I do. Eventually, the sun drags you forward. But I try to stay in my time zone if I can, because I do. I'm a sleep zealot.
Gretchen, we are laughing uncontrollably over here because you and I are just so similar. It's utterly absurd. I am a sleep zealot as well. I've never pulled an all-nighter in college. I never understood.
Neither. Why would you do that?
It makes no sense at all.
How would you get through college without it?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. No, so true.
All right, tendencies.
Wait. Hold on, I got one more. So my daughter is a swimmer. She's 11 years old. And I know I think it's either 14 or 15, they institute the 4:30 a.m. practices. I'm already devising my argument to bring to the swim club of like how this is so utterly absurd if you want high performing swimmers and other human beings. How could you possibly do that with a straight face? So anyway.
So you should read the book Internal Time by Till Ronenberg because it makes that case and it goes through all the data about how teenagers also are naturally moving to the night and all the research about schools and how test scores go up. These things that are very arbitrary and dictated, like the school bus route would have to change. And it's like, okay, I think that we can try to tackle that. So that book will give you lots of-
Thank
like,
you for helping bullet. Brad write his brief.
Oh yeah, this is great. I might ask for a quote from Gretchen Rubin, actually, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no, because it will directly affect performance in the negative, 100%.
All right, question number 4, the biggest financial mistake that you've made.
This is embarrassing, but I don't keep nearly as much of a close eye on like what's coming in and what's going out. And in fact, for 2020, I was like, I should make it money 2020 and really get much more granular on what's coming in and what's going out. Like I have a general sense, but like in terms of like ROI, okay, have I really calculated, like I have a big email newsletter. Have I really figured out what am I spending on it? Like really thinking through all those decisions. So it's like, I got money coming in, got money coming out. I don't have as clear a sense of that as I should.
We'll follow up with you at the end of your money 2020 and see the changes that you've made on this.
There you go. Yeah. I just love the rhyme. I'm like 2020, there has to be some money 2020 because I just love saying money 2020.
It's fantastic.
That is awesome.
I want clear vision 2020 on money in 2020.
You heard it here first.
Nice.
You heard it here first.
I think it's a movement. Hashtag.
All right, Gretchen, question number 5, the advice you would give your younger self.
Be Gretchen. So I have 12 personal commandments. That's my most important one. So be Gretchen is like, I want to expect more from myself, but I want to also accept myself. I think sometimes upholders feel like if I just put my mind to something, anything, I could be good at it and I should like learn to do everything. And there's no excuse for, you know, dropping the ball or whatever. Earlier, I had started saying, that's something that I want and that's a good aim for me. And this is something that I'm going to let that go. It's not that it's just not part of like who I am or what I value instead of feeling like, wow, with enough time, I'll do everything. You know, like I'm not that into music. And for a long time, I thought if I just went to concerts or listen to more music, or maybe I need to learn to read music. I don't really care about music that much. I can just let that go. Yeah. Then I have more time for the things that I like.
Yeah. Be Gretchen. I got you.
Gretchen.
All right, now we got a bonus question for you. What purchase have you made over the past 12 months that has brought the most value to your life?
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm sure it's a tool because I love tools. Oh, well, it's kind of silly. So it's not the most significant thing that you could do, but I have to say like on a day-to-day level, something that just brings me joy and kind of makes my life easier, I will show it.
Oh, yeah.
I purchased a bandolier, which is a phone case.
Wait, yeah. No, we're watching. Yeah, we're tracking.
It's a phone case. Yeah. And you can put it around your neck because I travel a tremendous amount. And I was always very concerned that I would leave my phone behind in an airport or, you know, like in a taxi or something. Because, you know, you're like, you're showing your boarding pass, but then you're in Hudson News buying like a pack of gum. And then it's like you put it down, you go to the bathroom, you're going through security. Like, do you have everything? Or also I'll just be like walking around my neighborhood, whatever. And this, I can just put it around my neck. And then I know it's not going to fall out of my purse or my bag. It's not going to fall out of my lap. I'm not going to leave it behind because it's literally around my neck. I saw it. I went to a conference and the conference organizers had it. And I thought that's so brilliant because you're organizing a conference. You're like, you're writing things down, you're moving things. You're constantly like putting your phone down and picking it up. And like men always have pockets, but a lot of times, and also I wear a lot of athleisure, like yoga pants with no pockets. So you are walking around with your phone around your neck. So you just sort of have to get cool with that situation. But I will say, I feel like it made my life much easier and probably saved me from some panic, you know, running after the taxi as it's speeding away from me. Like, oh my gosh, it's Brad, my phone.
Brad, I have a great gift idea for you. So we'll look into that. No, that's awesome. Fantastic.
That's really great.
All right. Yeah. Gretchen, someone's listening to this. They want to find out more about you and your content. They want to find out about what you're working on next. What's the best way for someone to do that?
So you can go to my website, which is the clearinghouse for everything. That's GretchenRubin.com. This is my name. If you want to listen more, the Happier with Gretchen Rubin podcast every week with my sister, we talk about how to be happier, healthier, more productive, and more creative. We're coming up on 100 million downloads. We're very excited about that. And then if you want to take the quiz, because we did talk about the tendency quite a bit, if you go to quiz.GretchenRubin.com, it's free. It's very quick. And it'll give you like a little report about the four tendencies and in particular about your tendency and point you to different directions if you want to learn more.
Gretchen, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's so much fun to talk to you.
If you got value from today's episode and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on, whether it be your podcast, Apple, Stitcher, or YouTube. Just lets a provider know that you got value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. And if you're interested in getting started on your own path to financial independence, the very simplest way would just be to go to choosefi.com/start. We've created an illustrated guide to FI that really gives you those basic steps that you need to really get started on your own path to financial independence. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.